Our guest today is our old friend Mark Michalish. Mark has worked for many of the top aerospace companies and has testified before the Disclosure Project and has appeared on several shows. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Great to be back.
There are different types of aviation. There are civilian air and space travel and military air and space travel. Let's talk a little bit about civilian air travel first.
Okay.
Boeing has decided to go with planes more of the current size, but with more luxury and more fuel efficiency, while Airbus has decided on planes that can carry even more passengers. Do you think that Airbus is unfair competition to Boeing since it's almost like a government entity?
Well, I think government support, government subsidies in the aerospace industry, it's nothing new. Many of the more recent developments in aviation have actually been multinational projects. Like, for example, I think it was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the X-31 program was a tactical fighter program that actually involved, I think it was four or five different countries, Canada, the United States, Germany. I think the British were involved also, but when you have advanced technologies that are being incorporated into the design of a new aircraft, especially with advancements in materials usage technology, these things can run in the billions of dollars in development. And so one of the ways that the various military organizations for these different countries have sought to sort of spread the cost over time and over the funding sources as best they could to spread it out, so to speak, is to divide up the costs among several different nations. And in that way, instead of, you know, a $460 billion development program costing U.S. taxpayers, you know, the entire tab, they can spread it out, say, four or five different ways between the different countries that will wind up being the end users for that particular airframe. So it's one of the ways that they can do that. It's also a way in which you can make the actual expense of development for an individual country to be less and hopefully in the end give them a greater market share, which is what Airbus has sought to do. I think Boeing has tried to get around that by finding multiple end users for their aircraft that would provide a way of funding these development and construction programs for these different aircraft that would help to reduce the cost. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's a good answer, Mark. But who do you think has the right philosophy? Do you think that the Boeing philosophy of building smaller, more efficient, more luxurious planes will win out in the end against building larger and larger planes?
Well, if the cost to the user, if the cost to the passenger doesn't increase in a dramatic way, it may be a better strategy. One of the problems that we had here in this country, in the United States, was that with the advent of the jumbo jet, the Boeing 747, and then the extended versions of that aircraft that eventually went into service, it started to become a problem where if they didn't have a flight completely booked with passengers, they were actually losing money every time the aircraft lifted off, because it's extremely expensive to operate a vehicle of that size with the tremendous fuel consumption that it has if you've only got one third of the plane filled with passengers. One of the other things that some of the airlines have tried to do is to offset the loss in passenger revenue with cargo carrying and airport to airport next day service. I mean, I've even used that in my illustration work when the deadline for a FedEx might be 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon when I was living in Los Angeles area and I had to get something to a client in New York the very next day. I could run down to LAX, Los Angeles International Airport, at midnight and put a painting in a crate on a Delta Airlines flight, Delta Air Cargo, and it would go onto a passenger plane in the cargo hold, and it would be delivered the next day by a local courier. And it would give me an additional, 6 to 8 hours to work on the illustration, which was, sometimes with the deadlines being what they were, that was a very valuable chunk of time. So there's all kinds of ways that you can cost these things out and get them to pay for themselves. But, when you have one strategy being one of, bulk passenger carrying and the other one being, sort of an exclusive approach where you have, a smaller commuter type aircraft, which tend to be more efficient in terms of the amount of fuel they use, and there are a lot more commuter flight, routes that are taken, going from city to city or from, one part of a country to another rather than flying international. That is a niche market that you see an awful lot more traffic locally, say between Los Angeles and San Diego or Los Angeles and San Francisco or, from Detroit to Phoenix. All of these different routes really don't require a jumbo jet, really don't require that kind of fuel use. And so the commuter luxury airline is a niche market which may actually expand dramatically in the next 5 years. So it's something that I think Boeing, they looked at different strategies for marketing their product, and I think they made a really great decision.
Well, it seems to me that Boeing has decided that the current large plane that they make has enough of a capacity to satisfy any airline.
It may be. The international flights, of course, they travel much greater distances. And if you're working with a larger aircraft like a 767, a 777, or, the different aircraft in the Airbus line, the A300, A310, and those aircraft, they're designed to carry a lot of people a very, very long distance. I mean, some of the flights, say, from I think it's San Francisco to Sydney, Australia, or something like 12 or 13-hour flights. And unless you're planning on stopping over in Hawaii, which most of these flight routes do not do, you're going to need a plane with that kind of a fuel carrying capacity. And so it's the kind of thing where you're looking at where you're going to see the most use of your product as the developer of an aircraft, and then look for ways to satisfy the needs of the route that you're going to be flying and how often it's going to be flying and what the average passenger load will be. And so it's, I think that, any aircraft producer, if they're smart, they're going to look at, what the application of their product is going to be and how well it'll satisfy the needs of the market. And I think that, I think perhaps Airbus any of the companies that are subcontractors to that, they're all looking for a particular market where they can sort of develop a reputation, and international air traffic is probably one that would be beneficial to them at this time because they're not as well known as, say, Boeing or Lockheed and some of those other companies.
A company named Rocket Plane Global, I don't know if you ever heard of them, they're going to use what looks like a business passenger jet plane with a rocket motor to take people on suborbital flights.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that current planes should be modified for space travel?
Well, if the FAA and the other certification boards can look at this and sign off on it, I mean, we certainly know enough about what the requirements of low Earth orbit are in terms of the stresses on the airframe and so forth. I think, when you get a plane up to 35 or 40,000 feet, you're talking about a very rarefied environment where there's very little air pressure. And it, in a way, it's almost like being in low Earth orbit because there's not a whole lot of pressure on the outside of the vehicle. The real problem comes from the pressurization of the capsule that the passengers sit inside of. It has to be airtight. There has to be environmental controls. You can't draw from outside air as a source of, you know, keeping everybody alive, so you have to have an onboard oxygen supply and a way to filter carbon dioxide out. So there's some modifications that would have to be made for that kind of situation. And first and foremost is that once you get outside the atmosphere, you can no longer depend on the wings or the tail and those kinds of things for controlling the attitude of the aircraft. You're going to have some kind of little pod that would strap onto the aircraft that will pretty much do the same thing as the maneuvering jets that are on the space shuttle that give it the opportunity to have little thrusters that'll give it, you know, the ability to produce yaw and pitch and rolling, movements when it's in an oxygen-free or an atmosphere-free environment.
It makes you sort of wonder, doesn't it? It makes you wonder if they could take, say, a 767 or something like that, modify it, and maybe take it to the moon.
Well, I mean, I remember seeing, I think it was, Space Cowboys or something. There was a film where they had redesigned a space shuttle, and they had adapted it to an outer space environment where it was intended to go out and meet an asteroid that was supposedly approaching.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't remember the title clearly.
I think you're right. I think it was Space Cowboys. Mm-hmm. But the thing is with the space shuttle, supposedly, the space shuttle, when it was designed, was supposed to be able to go out into space.
Well, and it did.
Go to the moon.
Oh. Well, see, now, I wasn't aware that the shuttle had been designed to go, out to the moon or something like that.
Well, that's been the rumor all along for many years, that the shuttle may have actually gone to the moon.
Well, I don't imagine that it ever landed there. It probably had some kind of little
module. Well, yeah, no, it wouldn't land. It wouldn't be capable of landing, I don't believe, but it might have been able to release a lander or something like that.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I worked with a fellow who was a former Rockwell International employee, Steve Wurst, who had come up with a company that he developed called Space Access, and what it did was something like what you're describing, where he developed a smaller scale version of something like a space shuttle that would be launched from under the wing of a larger carrier aircraft, kind of like the Spaceship One design mm-hmm. that Burt Rutan has come up with for Virgin Galactic. And but his design was a low cost Earth to orbit deployment system for satellites.
Mm-hmm.
And what he had come up with was a system where you didn't have to worry about depressurizing the payload bay like they apparently did with the space shuttle, which is kind of stressful on the airframe. He came up with a modular compartment that the satellite intended for a deployment would be mounted down inside of, and in the internal space of that compartment would be pre-evacuated, so that the only stresses occurring anywhere in the module were just in the module itself, not in the airframe of the aircraft, and then it would sit down into, it was almost like, a toaster or something that you put your toast in. You slide the module down into the slot in the backbone of the aircraft. It becomes a structural component in the airframe of the vehicle. And then once it gets out into space, it's lifted up out of the slot, a couple of doors open. It doesn't have to be evacuated, and it would deploy the satellite from there. And it was a very cheap, very inexpensive way to do things. And in the end, I think the problem was finding an aircraft that could be funded and retrofitted for the test and development phase of the project. But you know, the concept was really sound, and it's kind of what Burt Rutan ultimately came up with for Spaceship One in a similar sort of way, but you know, without deploying people, but at least taking them into low Earth orbit. So
I thought you were going to say he couldn't find any lobbyists to convince Congress to let him do it.
Well, you know, one of the aircraft that he'd actually considered was retired Russian military aircraft that had been part of their strategic bomber forces during the Cold War, because, you know, the Russians and their economy were really hurting at the time. It was the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were actually looking for ways to sell their military surplus. And in the end, I think it really boiled down to where was the money going to come from.
Right.
And, you know, it just for one individual to try and market a program that's, you know, that innovative but expensive is a difficult task. And I think in the end, he wasn't able to pull it off. But the concept was brilliant, in my view.
But why do you think that so many years after the Concorde was retired, we still don't have a passenger plane that flies faster than sound?
Well, I think it's a disappointment. I know that Boeing had a development program that they had looked at. It was kind of a new SST, a new supersonic transport or passenger aircraft, and they had some beautiful designs. I mean, it looked like this wonderful flying dart kind of a thing with a really nicely swept delta wing, but you know, it's really a question of, like I was saying before, whether you're going to be able to satisfy the needs of a specific market. I had family members back in the 1980s that actually flew on the Concorde, went over to France and spent a month over there touring Europe, and it was about $2,000 a person to fly from California over to London's Heathrow Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, it's not the kind of thing that, you know, you're going to be able to make a lot of use of. I mean, it's great for businessmen who have to get over there in a hurry, you know, for emergency meetings and that kind of thing. But for the average consumer, it's really something that would, you know, really suit the needs of people who had a lot more money and just, you know, wanted the exclusivity of it. But I don't know that it would actually be lucrative. I think in the end there were only 12 or 15 Concordes ever built. If I remember correctly.
And it wasn't too many, yeah.
No.
We've made great strides in computing over the years and in many other scientific fields. But if we are to believe what we see, we have made much progress in space. Do you believe this, or do you think that progress is being hidden from us?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that there is another very advanced program, and I couldn't tell you who is controlling it, whether it's you know, some branch of the United States military like U.S. Space Command, or whether there's some kind of an intelligence organization that's, you know, guiding the activities of a system like that, or a force of you know, off-world vehicles of one kind or another. But I can tell you that they do exist. I've seen them on many occasions. There is at least two bases in the mountains along the coast of California, west of where I live in Redding, which is about 2 hours north of Sacramento. And if you're willing to sit out in the wee hours of the night, night after night on clear nights, and we have a lot of clear nights here in this area, you can see these things coming in and approaching these two particular specific sites. One appears to be in the Trinity Mountains, roughly north-northwest of the community of Weaverville, the other one is somewhere west of the city of Red Bluff, which is about 35 to 40 miles south of Redding, right on Interstate 5. And I've seen things in the skies up here in Northern California that they challenged my belief as to what I was seeing. I mean, I've literally seen what appeared to be the opening of a wormhole and objects coming out of those brilliant flashes of light in the sky on several occasions. I've seen large cylindrical or what some people call cigar-shaped vehicles glowing a brilliant white coming into the area at tremendous velocity and then literally disappearing from sight as you watch them as though they've gone into some kind of a visual stealth mode. But the one thing that I noticed was, and this is what kind of set them apart from, you know, say a meteor falling out of the sky, is that typically when a meteor, you know, falls to Earth, it starts out at one speed and it gets faster as it falls, you know, just like anything else. But in the instance of these things that I've observed on a dozen or more occasions, they not only change direction, which meteors never do, but they also slow down as they get closer to the Earth. So it's, you know, pretty obvious that there is something artificial.
Well, Gary McKinnon had said that he had discovered the names of officers and ships from a space fleet that we have docked out in space when he got onto one of the, I think it was a NASA website, but part of it mm-hmm. that was secret.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that?
Now, Gary McKinnon, of course, is the fellow who hacked into the Pentagon and the other classified websites.
That's correct.
On what used to be called DARPANET, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency's original network of computers for the defense industry in the United States. I do believe that, and it doesn't surprise me. In fact, I think one of the code names for this off-world force was Solar Warden. That's a name that comes up over and over again. And there's you know, some photographs that I've been privy to over the years. There's a friend I have here locally that who contacted me after an appearance I did on Coast to Coast some years ago, and we became good friends. And back in the early 1980s, her husband was up in the northeastern part of California near the community of Cedarville, really kind of an isolated area. But there's an awful lot of flight testing that goes on up in that area in a region that's sort of in the northeast corner of California and the northwest corner of Nevada. In an area called the Surprise Valley, of all things.
Yeah, that's a good name for
and,
it.
you know, there have been dozens of people who photographed everything from what looked to be flying saucers to some really bizarre-looking aircraft, one of which this fellow had photographed near Cedarville, and it was an aircraft that appeared to be in trouble, and the photograph was a Polaroid that was taken from the roadway. I think it was Route 399, which runs along the backbone of Nevada and California along the border there. But there are all these people who had stopped in their vehicles and are all standing out and they're looking at this thing in the distance. And under magnification, you can see very clearly that it's sort of a flying wing kind of design, very large. He estimated that it was somewhere between 300 and 600 feet on a side, but it had the same kind of faceted surfacing that later appeared, about 6 to 8 years later, appeared on the F-117 stealth fighter.
Uh-huh.
But this thing was immense, and it had three large glowing spheres, one right up at the front at the apex of this sort of V-shaped platform, and then it had another silvery sort of glowing sphere at the midpoint of each of these objects that you might call wings, except that they were much thicker and did not have the obvious purpose of aerodynamic lift. They were not shaped like your typical wing that you would expect air to flow over. They actually looked like a large crystalline structure with all these odd shapes and things, but basically the shape of the aircraft was a large kind of a wing. And the way he described it was the vehicle appeared to be in trouble, and it was several hundred feet off the ground, pointed nose down, and banked at about a 30-degree angle to the left, and it was just hovering there motionlessly. It was making this very loud, very deep, pulsating, throbbing, kind of a humming sound that could be heard from a quarter of a mile away. You could feel it in your chest. It was so powerful. And he said that this thing was completely black, except for these three domes that you could see on the top surface of it. And it had a row of red lights that kind of ran up off the point of the vehicle and on either side of the dome that was right in the front. But that he said that after 25 minutes to a half an hour of all these people stopping and watching this thing, that apparently whoever was in control of this had figured out a way to reverse its course, and it basically flipped end over end. It basically, the nose came up, and as it began to flip basically over onto its back, it continued that roll to the left side so that it basically wound up pointing in the opposite direction, wings level. And it was pointed upward at about a 40 to 45 degree angle, and it slowly began to climb out, and it got up to about 5,000 feet, and then it just was gone like a
bullet. Well, you know, I have to say, when you describe these domes, all I can think about is the domes that were supposedly under these UFOs that are really anti-gravity engines, supposedly.
Yeah. That is something that seems to be apparent almost uniformly throughout the eyewitness descriptions that you see. In a lot of these what are thought to be, vehicles that are of extraterrestrial origin. Based on everything that I've seen, Lockheed, later to be Lockheed Martin, had some kind of an anti-gravity development program as early as around 1963, 1964. And it, you know, this is really only a little less than 20 years after, the alleged crash in 1947 of some kind of an off-world vehicle in Roswell, New Mexico,
even before that, the Germans had a device called the Bell,
and
it was believed to be some sort of a anti-gravity device. The problem was it was killing all their scientists that had some type of radiation that we're not familiar with. Mm-hmm. But we supposedly captured it at the end of the war, and we've been working on it ever since, according to the rumors, you know.
Well, based on everything that I've seen, and I've had occasion to talk to people who actually have seen these things in military hangars. I have a friend who actually saw three of them at Lockheed Skunk Works in 1988. That device that was described by Joe Farrell and a number of other authors, I think Timothy Good in the his book, The Hunt for Zero Point, I think it was, they described this device, the so-called Nazi Bell, which was being developed up in Poland in the Wencelis mine.
That's right.
And it was described as a bell, or Der Glockenspiel, which is the German word for the bell. And it was a pair of counter-rotating cylinders, one inside of the other, that had a solution of mercury, thorium, which is a mildly radioactive material, and something called beryllium peroxide. Now, I've done an awful lot of searching, and I have not been able to find any kind of, high oxygenated derivative of beryllium. I mean, you can find beryllium oxide, but beryllium peroxide, I've never been able to find that anywhere. I'm not even sure that it actually exists. But in some of the discussions I've had with people who claim to know something about this, one of whom is a well-known physicist, my question was, if you were working with a system that would develop extremely high voltages, and you were using mercury as a solution for creating some kind of an effect by having electricity, coursing through it at a high voltage, what would be the purpose of including fine powdered version of thorium? And his statement was that he thought that having a mildly radioactive material in that solution would reduce the threshold of emission, which is a phrase that sort of suggests that if you've got some kind of radiation or particles, gamma rays, something like that, that might be created in the process, the addition of something that's already mildly radioactive in the solution would actually help it to achieve its purpose more easily. Now, one of the alternatives, one of the things that I don't think has been explored in that particular instance, is that aside from the fact that it may have achieved some kind of anti-gravity effects, we know that it did produce some kind of radiation that apparently killed just about anyone standing near the device when they first tried it, when they first fired it off. There's some suggestion that it may have been producing nuclear radiation or neutrons. And if you think about it, though, this is exactly the kind of mechanism that you would want to have if you were trying to refine and create weapons-grade material. Like plutonium-238 dioxide or something of that nature. You may actually be looking at the very reason why many of these propulsion systems are so classified, not because of their capabilities, not because they can, travel at, incredibly high speeds, and make these incredible maneuvers and everything else because they defy the forces of gravity, but because the design of the system itself is relatively simple, and if it'll produce neutron radiation, that means that you could actually take a material like thorium, which sits practically right next to plutonium on the periodic table, and you could transmute the material through neutron bombardment and turn it into a low-cost, high-speed way of creating nuclear materials, weapons-grade materials. This may be the reason why these technologies are still so classified.
Well, wouldn't you think if that was true, though, that they wouldn't be using centrifuges anymore? They'd be using something
exactly
like that to create the... But
exactly.
yet, if you look all over the world, you see nothing but centrifuges used to make nuclear bombs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, this is something that... This sort of reemphasizes and sort of validates what I was saying, is that if you knew that you could take a relatively simple device like the Nazi Bell, if in fact you knew what the materials were that you had to use to produce it, and you knew what the orientation of the components were, whether you have big coils of copper wire around it that are embedded in a particular kind of material, and you put all those things together and you were able to produce, usable quantities of weapons-grade material in a very short amount of time, of course you wouldn't be spending millions of dollars on centrifuges and years trying to get together just a small enough amount of, 12, 15 pounds of weapons-grade material to actually create a bomb. So, If you did have a low cost and simple and quick way to do that, you'd have every two-bit dictator around the world, every terrorist organization in the world, looking for ways to develop an anti-gravity propulsion system if they thought that this was one of the byproducts that they could use as leverage in the world, in the world of politics.
Well, then let me ask you this, since we happen to be on this subject. What do you think of the fact that in the 60s in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, something crashed that looked just like the Nazi Bell?
I think it's pretty well decided that that event did occur, that it's not just, you know, a local myth or something. And the fact that it strongly resembled the Nazi Bell, it's a pretty disturbing thought. The witnesses that describe seeing this thing come into the woods outside of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, said that it was clearly intelligently controlled, that it wasn't just, you know, a rock falling out of the sky, but that it actually seemed to have some kind of, you know, maneuverability.
It also would have made it more than just a motor. It would have made it a capsule with a motor.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps somebody that. Inside. Yes, and perhaps with someone inside, too.
Yeah, you know, maybe. I mean, who knows?
You know, that would probably be the next serious question that I would want to ask if I you know, had the ability to find a source inside the military who had, you know, the answers to these questions. Was, you know, was it a human being on board, or was it, you know, someone or something from somewhere else? You know, it kind of makes you wonder. I mean, if you look at where Kecksburg, Pennsylvania is, and you look at, you know, where the early stages of the Manhattan Project got off the ground in terms of, you know, the northeastern part of the United States and the early development of, you know, nuclear weapons and so forth, it kind of makes you wonder if maybe this wasn't something that was being flight tested one night and they, you know, lost power or something. You know, maybe it didn't function in the way that they'd hoped.
Or maybe the Nazis didn't develop the Bell. Maybe they captured it.
Well, you know, there is a lot of discussion. I know that there have been a number of people, David Hatcher Childress, Sean David Morton, and a number of other people have said that they've heard stories from inside NASA and other places. I guess Sean's father was working for NASA for many years, and there's a lot of discussion that the Germans and the Nazis in particular had either had some kind of interaction with an off-world intelligence, or that they had actually captured, made, you know, one of the first crash recoveries of one of these vehicles, and were trying to back engineer it themselves.
Yeah, I've heard that, but, you know, I have a hard time with that because I don't even know if we got one today, if we could back engineer it. Although they say that we do have them, but, you know, you have to wonder. Nobody really knows for sure, you know.
Well, you know, I understand where you're coming from on that. Nobody really seems to know for sure, but, you know, if you spent any time in the mountains around places like China Lake Naval Weapons Range or Edwards Air Force Base, and just spent a lot of time at night watching the skies over there, you can see things flying around at night.
Oh, I don't doubt that. I just mean that maybe we're a lot more advanced than we think we are.
I believe that.
You know what I mean?
I believe
and
that
a lot of these things are us. You know, they're from us.
Yes, I do believe that. In fact, as a percentage, I've stated publicly on a number of occasions that I really think that about 85% of what people see and think are UFOs are actually Earth-based and truly advanced weapon systems that are being held tightly under wraps.
I mean, for example, take the pulse jet.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with this, but Google Earth had tracings of a pulse jet going across not only the United States, but across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be a pulse jet because of the way that you could actually see puffs, you know what I mean? As it went across, every so often it'd be like a puff, and then it'd be a straight line. And the only thing I know of that does that is a pulse jet. And this would have to be going at least 8,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Which,
well, one of the, I think I told you this story once before, but I had been commissioned in the mid to late 1980s by Lockheed, back when they had a division in Calabasas, California. to do some conceptual artwork on a new family of aircraft. And this, as it was explained to me, was that there was a classified family of aircraft. They didn't name the aircraft at the time, but I later discovered that the name of this family of aircraft was under a code name, Aurora.
Yeah.
And that they had some problems with the first deployed version of this aircraft, which pretty much had kind of a flattened out diamond shape with four high bypass turbojet engines inside this sort of lifting body shape, which also happens to be quite stealthy because of the way it's designed. But it also had a slight ridge that ran laterally across the top and the ventral or the bottom, the belly of the aircraft, at the widest point. And along the trailing edge of this ridge were a series of what looked like fuel injectors, but they were pointed outward. And the four engines on the inside of the aircraft would allow it to take off and land. And once it got up to about Mach 2, the inlets for the four engines on the outside of the aircraft would all slam shut, so they were perfectly smooth. And this thing would begin spraying fuel into the supersonic shockwave that would separate from the surface of the aircraft right where this ridge was. It's what they call wake separation. And because the air was so highly compressed and superheated by the sheer velocity of this aircraft, that the fuel would spontaneously explode, and it would expand between the tapered afterbody of the vehicle and the supersonic shockwave, and so it would create this pinching effect that would drive the entire aircraft forward. It's kind of like a linear aerospike engine, which uses the same principle, except that instead of having, you know, several of these engines along the trailing edge of the aircraft, like the follow-up of the space shuttle design that was developed by Lockheed, they instead turn the entire tail end of the aircraft into one giant linear aerospike engine.
Yeah, and you know, that's not the first time. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but many years ago, one of the designs for a spaceship that would be capable of traveling between stars was a nuclear ship that actually exploded nuclear bombs behind
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that design had its origin back in the 1950s, and I think that was before they really realized that in the vacuum of space, a nuclear bomb going off is really just going to produce radiation and heat, but it's not actually going to produce a shockwave because there's no atmosphere to deliver the shockwave.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the reasons why I think that idea kind of fell apart. But you were talking about the pulsing exhaust trail that was left by these tracks that were seen on Google Earth, and this, in fact, was how this externally burning fuel delivery system worked, because even though the entire outside of this first generation Aurora aircraft was covered completely with space shuttle tiles, continuous burning of that sort of linear aerospike configuration on the back end of the vehicle, it created so much heat that it would actually cause the tiles to begin to erode and melt.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to pulse the fuel coming out the back of it. So, in fact, I actually, when I first moved to Northern California in 1994, there was a lot of instability in North Korea. I think the health of the leader over there was faltering. And so about every 20 minutes, every 40 minutes, we would have one of these things flying over Redding, and it was going from the southeast to the northwest, and it appeared to be coming from probably Area 51 and passing directly over this area. And I actually made a couple of time exposures with my camera sitting on a tripod of these things flying overhead, and the way you could see it was that the back end of the aircraft would heat up and glow, and you could see it glowing for about 5 seconds, then it would go out for about 10 to 15 seconds, and then even though hydrogen fuel, when it burns, it's pretty much transparent, but the radiant energy that was accumulating and basically causing the shuttle tiles on the tail end of this thing to glow, you could see that and you could photograph it.
Yeah.
And so when I, you know, developed the film, it actually looked like this dashed line running across a star background.
Well, now they don't even need the shuttle tiles. They have aerogel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there. Well, actually, silica-based aerogel is actually a it's a very. I mean, it's like soap bubbles made out of silica.
I know. It's like
and
nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but it doesn't really provide any thermal protection per se. It's really something that they've actually looked at designing very large, what they call lighter than air vehicles out of aerogel. And instead of filling them with, lighter-than-air gases like helium or hydrogen, which, you know, was what brought about the demise of the Hindenburg, but instead of creating the silica aerogel and filling it with lighter-than-air gases, they've actually come up with a process for creating these percolating, bubbling catalytic reactions that occur in the creation of silica aerogel, where the individual cells, the individual bubbles, are actually like little pockets of vacuum. So it's even more effective than lighter than air or heated air or helium or hydrogen. It's almost like having a chunk of outer space that you're carrying around in a bag. And when the stuff solidifies, of course, it's not very robust or strong, but if you put a skin over it, if you put like a Kevlar or carbon fiber skin around the aerogel packet, it's extremely buoyant. And in fact, to give you an example of how much buoyancy you can generate, let's say you had a balloon that was shaped like a giant loaf of bread that was the size of a city bus, and you filled it with hot air. At sea level, that city bus-sized hot air balloon would lift a Chevy big block engine, 500 pounds mm-hmm. of steel. Yeah. So if you scale that up to something that's 3/4 or a mile long and 1/4 mile wide, and I'm making reference to the thing that was seen flying over Phoenix in March of 1997, you get something that size, and you can put a bunch of Abrams tanks in that thing and fly them around the world. And if you have internally mounted jet engines, like the kind of engine you'd find on a jumbo jet, you can acoustically cancel the noise from the jets because they're down inside the vehicle, and you can have nozzles that are on the top, look like little snorkels that'll rotate around, and you can actually have vectored thrust that'll allow this thing to fly at speeds up to about 450 miles an hour, which, you know, it's funny because I don't think anybody else besides me actually did this, but I took all of the eyewitness accounts from Henderson, Nevada, all the way down to Tucson, Arizona, the time to distance, you know, the mm-hmm. the eyewitness account, who saw it where, and, you know, Payson, Prescott, you know, north of, around Flagstaff and then down around Phoenix and Tucson and so forth, and I plotted the time to distance across the map, and this thing never traveled faster than 450 miles an hour, which is exactly what you'd expect with a very large lighter-than-air vehicle that was using an internal jet propulsion system. And so, you know, that's not much faster than, you know, a P-51 Mustang from the Second World War, but when you talk about the capability of lifting, you know, 20 mm-hmm. or 30 M1 Abrams tanks, you know, this would be a perfect vehicle for a rapid deployment force, and that's probably what it's being used for.
Are you aware of the fact that aerogel... there's many different kinds of aerogel. They're not all silica.
Well, that was the only one that I'm aware of. I mean, I really haven't even looked at aerogel.
There's all different kinds. They can substitute carbon instead of silica and aluminum and all kinds of things. And when they do, it becomes a very good insulator. That's why I said that it could be used in place of a tile on a space shuttle, I believe,
mm-hmm.
because it has this certain property, whereas it dissipates infrared energy mm-hmm. in one of its forms, and it's very efficient.
Well, I imagine that it would be. I mean, I know that even as recently as 5 to 10 years ago, there was actually a process that they had developed for creating what you would call metallic foam. It was actually a way of creating lots of air bubbles inside of steel or aluminum or even things like titanium. And these kinds of materials, and this is where material science becomes such an important and integral part in aerospace technology. These kinds of materials not only insulate against extreme heat, but they also offer a tremendous amount of acoustic absorption, where you can put them around the tail end of an aircraft, around the exhaust cone, and help to absorb a lot of the sound energy that's coming from a jet engine. Now, most people don't know that when you have the roaring sound that comes from a jet engine, most of that noise is actually coming from the shearing forces, where the hot exhaust gases are basically coming out of the exhaust cone of a jet engine at extremely high velocity, and they're basically cutting or shearing through sort of a homogeneous, steady, stagnant air mass, and that's, so it's like a cutting sound, really. But if you can find ways to spread out and disperse the exhaust blast, you're not really taking away any of the thrust. What you are doing is you're cutting down on the thrust, or I should say the shearing forces that cause all the noise. And this is one of the things that they did on the tail end of the stealth fighter. If you've ever looked at a model or seen photographs of the aircraft, they actually had a... imagine that you take one of those little plastic cones that you use to put oil in your engine so you don't spill it all over the engine when you pour the oil in. You take that, the wide end of it, and you flatten it out. And that's kind of what they did with the tail end of the exhaust cone on the stealth fighter. They took a flared cone like that, and they flattened it out. So it took this one cylindrical core of exhaust gases, and it spread it out into a thin layer so it didn't have the same degree of shearing forces, so the stealth fighter actually is much quieter than it ordinarily would have been otherwise. Mm-hmm.
A Russian general stated that Russia lost to the Americans in the race to develop military aircraft because we already had space planes. Does this statement surprise you?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, there's even a former Russian cosmonaut who has drawn pictures of some of the things that he saw, and he thought were alien vehicles, but if you look at them, they look remarkably like some of the conceptual artwork that was produced on really advanced stealth fighters with the wingtips kind of curled downward in a strange-looking mm-hmm. configuration with very shallow vertical stabilizers on the wings that were canted inward, that had... NACA duct-type inlets up near the front of the aircraft. And these are all things that were incorporated into the drawings that this cosmonaut did. In fact, one of the giveaways of the drawing was that there was a cockpit bubble up near the front.
Right. Well, in World War II, we all know the Germans were way ahead of us, but there is this rumor that they were even further ahead of us in rocketry than we were allowed to find out at the end of World War II. Excuse me, and that they possibly made it to the moon. What do you think of that?
Well, I know that there's a low-budget film being developed right now by a crew over in Europe. I think it's called Iron Sky, and it really sort of hinges on that entire concept that you just brought up, the idea that the Germans may, in fact, have... mastered rocketry to the point of being able to get to the moon, and that this is one of the reasons why Wernher von Braun was such an important capture in Operation Paperclip at the end of the war, where we managed to bring back a number of their top scientists from their rocketry programs. Argument that I would offer in opposition to that is that as someone who has seen the live television broadcast of the Saturn V leaving on some of the last few Apollo missions, if you recognize how big and how powerful and how noisy and how really obnoxiously noticeable a vehicle of that size is, I can't imagine that the Germans would have had the capability for launching a vehicle of that size without somebody somewhere noticing. They certainly didn't have the kind of ships available that would have allowed them to take this thing out in the middle of the ocean somewhere where there might not be anyone nearby that would be able to witness a launch. And so I sincerely doubt that they ever did have that capability. They may have had things like that on the drawing board, but in terms of their actually being able to pull it off without anyone else noticing, I really seriously doubt.
It's hard to believe that aside from the ion engine, a very weak engine that only works in space, that we have not come up with any other more usable forms of propulsion that would allow us to travel to the stars. Ben Rich, who replaced Kelly Johnson at the Lockheed Skunk Works, stated that we already had the means to travel to the stars. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going on here with these contradictory statements?
Well, I've talked to people who have actually seen some of the systems that Lockheed ultimately developed. In fact, I've talked to probably a dozen different witnesses who've actually seen these things, either inside Lockheed Skunk Works or seen these craft coming and going from Lockheed Skunk Works. And they look like your stereotypical flying saucer from outer space. The most recent versions of which are all black. They look like a large lens-shaped vehicle with a slight dome on the top. I would say that the diameter is approaching something around 200 to 250 feet in diameter. Typically, they've been seen to have kind of a greenish, almost like a large series of greenish-blue fluorescent lights around the outer edge, sort of reminiscent of some of the large craft that were seen in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I've talked to witnesses who've seen this both coming and going from Lockheed Skunk Works in the middle of the week, and happened to get a ticket from a local sheriff's deputy in Palmdale when I was there doing some work for another company that's right at Air Force Plant 42, which is where Skunk Works is based. And in the course of discussing some of the things that I had heard from some of these eyewitnesses, part of that story involved the Lancaster County Sheriff's Department coming in and blocking off the surrounding streets, because at one time, you know, Air Force Plant 42 was out in the middle of nowhere, and now it's completely surrounded by suburbs and industrial parks and things, so there's a lot of traffic all around the base now. And so in order to prevent the public from seeing some of these classified aircraft, which basically come and go from the east end of the field, they block off all the surrounding streets so the traffic can't get close enough to these runways and buildings to actually see something coming or going. And so it turns out that the sheriff's deputies have a unique vantage point in being able to see what it is that's happening inside Air Force Plant 42. And they, in fact, confirmed what I had been told by witnesses who actually worked at Air Force Plant 42, that they were these large disc-shaped craft which come in, hover over an area of the ramp just to the east side of the Skunk Works building, which is at the extreme west end of the base, and that they're met by a group of vehicles that look like these motorized turret vehicles that the power company uses, you know, with the basket that goes up mm-hmm. on an arm, and the
right.
controller can drive this little turret around on the ground while he's up working on the power line without having to go back down each time to move it. And that a cluster of these vehicles in a circle, you know, 12 or 15 of these vehicles would be in a circle, and each one of the baskets would be supporting a portion of a big tarp that made a big cylindrical blind that this thing would then lower, you know, sort of slowly descend in a hover mode, come down and land behind this blind. And then the vehicles will all extend their arms inward towards the middle, and the whole cluster of vehicles would then trundle into the Skunk Works building, and the hangars would close, and then all the lights on the facility would come back on. Mm. But the other eyewitnesses were people who worked at some of the other contractors who said that, you know, after, I think it was about 1985 or 86, there was a law passed that you could not smoke inside any federal facility, which included any defense contractor who was receiving federal dollars to, you know, build weapon systems. And so they created these little outdoor areas, you know, picnic tables and stuff, where the employees could go out, you know, about 10 minutes every 2 hours and smoke a cigarette or something. And these are the people who saw these things and said, oh, yeah, I was having a cigarette when. So, and that was the only reason I would have, you know.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I pointed that out many times on my website, that one of the greatest boons to spotting UFOs has been people having to go outside to smoke.
It's true.
It is, because they go out 3 in the morning, some of them work nights, and,
yeah,
you know, and they see all kinds of things up in the sky.